From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Martha Wexler. This week, the U.S. military lowers its flag over Iraq. Italians protest austerity. The French look at a Europe dominated more and more by Germany. And China's wolf dad makes the tiger mom look like a pussycat. Nearly 9 years after the war in Iraq began, the United States marked the end of its military mission there on Thursday. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta was on hand for the Casing of the Colors in Baghdad. NPR's Kelly McEvers was also at the ceremony and filed this report.
Let's be clear. These ceremonies have been going on for weeks now in Iraq, closing bases, handing over equipment, sending soldiers home in planes and armored vehicles. Still, about 3,500 soldiers remain in Iraq. That's down from nearly 200,000 at the height of the war. Hundreds of soldiers are leaving Iraq each day. At today's ceremony, Commanding General Lloyd Austin said the withdrawal will be completed in the coming days. He says it's a poignant moment for someone who was part of the initial invasion of Iraq.
I gave the order for the lead elements of the division to cross the border. As fate would have it, I now give the order to case the colors today.
Austin was joined by Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, who spoke to the small crowd of Iraqi and American officials and military personnel. Panetta assured those gathered that the nearly 4,500 Americans and more than 100,000 Iraqis who lost their lives lost them for a good cause.
Those lives have not been lost in vain. They gave birth to an independent, free, and sovereign Iraq. And because of the sacrifices made, these years of war have now yielded to a new era of opportunity.
The ceremony was subdued, considering it's the end of nearly 9 years at war. General Frank Helmick said that's the way the commanders wanted it.
You know, we don't want a lot of fanfare for what we've done here. We pride ourselves on being quiet professionals, and that's what our military is made of, quiet professionals. No one can do what the American military did in this country. No one.
Whether what the military did in this country will be called a success, most here agree that's still a matter for debate. The dictator is gone. Iraq has an elected parliament. But the political system is deeply divided along sectarian and ethnic lines. Iraqis still have only a few hours of electricity each day. The oil industry is only now coming online. And while violence is down from previous years, low-level attacks are still the norm. For their part, Iraqis haven't missed the chance to celebrate the departure of the Americans. In the infamous city of Fallujah, thousands of Iraqis recently gathered for what they called a day of victory. Speeches and songs celebrated those who fought and died in what Fallujis call the resistance against the American occupation. In 2004, the U.S. fought two fierce battles in Fallujah where hundreds of people died. The city is still battered and slowly trying to come back to life. Iraq is beautiful, this man says in a speech to the crowd. Do not forget about its glory, even when it is facing a hard time. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
Coming up, the bitter medicine of austerity in Europe. Italy's new Prime Minister Mario Monti has the nickname Super Mario. He'll have to be a superhero to get his country to accept the tough austerity plan he's devised to rein in the country's debt and reassure the markets. One pill that's proving especially hard for Italians to swallow is pension reform. Monti is raising the retirement age by 5 or 6 years, effective immediately. Here's NPR's Silvio Poggioli in Rome.
Anti-austerity protests are popping up everywhere. On a shopping street decked out with Christmas decorations, demonstrators wear masks and Santa Claus costumes. A woman on a loudspeaker shouts, "We're going to occupy Christmas and protest against all the new measures. People can't buy any presents this year because they have to pay all the new taxes." On Sunday, hundreds of thousands of women throughout Italy took to the streets to rally against a package of measures they say do nothing to help women juggle work and the family. Lack of daycare and services for the elderly means that 50% of Italian women stay home, one of the lowest female employment rates in the Western world. And sociologist Chiara Saraceno says there's no trade-off in raising women's retirement age.
You cannot say that you want more women in the labor force and that they work longer, but at the same time, you not only do not develop services which are already scarce, but even cut the resources for it.
Another criticism leveled against Monti's austerity package is that it does not do enough to combat one of Europe's highest tax evasion rates. According to official statistics, it's close to 18% of GDP, or $300 billion annually. Particularly galling to many Italians is that Monti's new property tax will not be applied to church-owned property, even if used for commercial purposes. At another demo, activists put stickers on church-owned buildings in Rome. Gianfranco Mascia points to the Hotel Ponte Sisto. It's a church-owned building, he says, and we would like to know why this four-star hotel will be exempt from paying the new property tax while we have to pay it. Francesco Benetti says if taxed, church real estate could provide a revenue of up to $1 billion.
The church owns a lot. Just in Rome, there are 300 of structures that could be taxated, but they are not. Activities like shops, like restaurants, like hotels, they are not churches, they are not places of cult.
The strongest protest comes from Italy's three major unions, which for the first time in 6 years overcame divisions and staged a joint general strike. Hundreds of workers rallied outside parliament. 60-year-old Emanuela Conforto was given an incentive by her employer to retire early and get her pension next year. But now the new measures force her to wait another 5 to 6 years, so she's without work and without a pension.
How am I going to live? My 33-year-old son can't find a job. My mother has a pension of $675 a month. I have a mortgage. I have to help out both my mother and my son. So how are we going to manage?
Susanna Camuso, leader of the biggest union, addressed the crowd of angry workers.
This government promised it would pursue fairness, rigor, and growth. But all we see is rigor, and it's directed against the lowest salaries. There is no rigor for the wealthy. It's time for them to start paying. Otherwise, this country will never take off.
Prime Minister Monti has justified the absence of a special tax on the wealthy, saying it would simply lead to capital flight. But his government faces more protest strikes. Silvio Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
The austerity now imposed in Italy and elsewhere is Germany's prescription to solve Europe's debt crisis. Germany has the continent's biggest economy, and as its neighbors sink deeper and deeper into debt, the Germans have more and more clout. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has been trying to find out how the French feel about this seeming shift in the balance of power in Europe. She sent us this report from Paris.
Nowhere is a newly empowered Germany more threatening to the national psyche than in France. And for the last few weeks, the topic of a German resurgence in Europe has been the focus of public debate. Magazine editors have their say on this news talk show, one of the many devoted to the so-called Germanization of Europe. Bruno Roger Petit is with left-leaning weekly Le Nouvel Observateur.
Today, our sovereignty has been completely amputated under German pressure. Unprecedented antisocial budgets of austerity and suffering are being imposed on us by a Europe under German dictate.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy has gone to great lengths to sell the new European pact he negotiated with Chancellor Angela Merkel as made in Germany and France. In a nationally televised speech last week, Sarkozy told the French they should not fear losing their sovereignty. France, Germany, and Europe have the same goals, he said. But the opposition socialists charged that Sarkozy had given away the store.
Atteint l'objectif des 3% en 2013.
In a noisy parliamentary session, Socialist Radical Party head Jean-Marc Ayrault says Merkel got everything she wanted. She got her way on Eurobonds and the role of the European Central Bank. So where exactly does France come in, he asked. Another prominent socialist compared Sarkozy to Édouard Daladier, the French premier who signed the 1938 Munich Accord ceding part of Czechoslovakia to Hitler.
Et ça, c'est quoi?
C'est ma facture de téléphone.
A satirical political puppet show has had a field day with Merkel's apparent domination of Sarkozy. In this skit, Sarkozy has to get his phone bills approved by a school marmish-looking Merkel who yells at him for having too many long-distance calls. References to Germany's warmongering past have been popping up all over Europe. In Greece, there is talk of a Fourth Reich, and Italian television has depicted Merkel wearing a Kaiser helmet with a spike. But in France, the hand-wringing over Germany's ascension seems to be more about politicking just 5 months before a presidential election. Out on the streets, I can't find anyone who feels threatened by next-door neighbor Deutschland. Au contraire, 59-year-old Jean Lechen works 7 days a week to bring his fruits and vegetables to Paris street markets like this one. He says it's impossible to find good help because of France's 35-hour work week. The Germans are more disciplined than the French, he says. That's why they're doing okay. We all need to be operating on the same level in Europe for it to work. The Italians, Spanish, Portuguese, everybody. Inside Paris bistro Le Gaulois, a lunchtime crowd gathers for hearty French dishes like veal sauté and escargot. French food is the best, says patron Pierre Guimet, but he says he has no problem following German ways when it comes to the economy.
What they're saying in the media is baloney. We are working with the Germans and within Europe. They're the leaders, but they're working alongside France, and we need stricter fiscal rules. It's a good thing.
The owner of Le Gaulois says he's too busy for an interview, but as I head out the door, he tells me, we've come out of two world wars. It's certainly not Germany or a closer Europe that scares us, he says. It's the Chinese. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR's Foreign Dispatch. I'm Martha Wexler. One of the most talked about books this year was Amy Chua's memoir, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. The Chinese-American mom wrote about banning sleepovers and threatening to take away toys if her kids' piano playing wasn't perfect. Turns out Amy Chua is a pushover compared to her mainland Chinese equivalent, Wolf Dad. His book was originally titled Beat Them into Peking University. NPR's Louisa Lim reports that it sparked a big debate in China about how to raise kids.
The latest media sensation in China, a father who not just beat his kids but boasts about how he did it. Wolf Dad, as he's been nicknamed, has been doing the chat shows. He's been laying out his system for getting three of his four kids into China's top school, Peking University. 47-year-old Xiao Baiyou describes himself as the emperor of his family. As such, he's laid down an extraordinary system of rules for his children.
1,000, more than 1,000.
I have more than 1,000 rules, specific detailed rules about how to hold your chopsticks and your bowl, how to pick up food, how to hold a cup, how to sleep, how to cover yourself with a quilt. If you don't follow the rules, then I must beat you.
What happens if you sleep the wrong way at night, I ask? Then I'll beat the child in the morning, he answers. For each violation of the rules, the penalty is to be hit with a feather duster on the legs or on the palm of the hand. If it doesn't leave a mark, then it won't make an impact, Wolf Dad believes. Never mind sleepovers, his kids weren't even allowed friends. He started beating them when they were 3 and stopped when they got to 12.
From 3 to 12, kids are mainly animals. Their humanity and social nature still aren't complete, so you have to use Pavlovian methods to educate them.
His oldest, a 22-year-old son, has his doubts about his father's methods, and he's quoted as saying he's not even sure he had a childhood. In many countries, Wolf Dad's behavior would be seen as child abuse, but Xiao denies that.
In China, beating kids is part of their upbringing. It's not violence. It's not against the law. If this kind of beating is legal, scientific, and in the interests of the kids, then fine. I'm all for beating since it's effective.
My God, have you asked your children what they want? Says this woman, one of Wolf Dad's many critics. But his book has been flying off the shelves. So far, 120,000 have been printed, and he says most have been sold. Another contrasting media sensation has sharpened the debate in China. It's a small, scrappy exercise book filled with primitive line drawings. The Complete Book of Combat with Mum contains 20 strategies to deflect a scolding from your mother, and was written by 2 Beijing 10-year-olds.
Move number 4 is useful. You run to mom and throw yourself on her. Lots of kids say they use this because it makes mom's heart go soft and it makes her cry.
That's Chen Le Shui, nicknamed Dang Dang, who wrote the book with her friend Deng Xinyi after a particularly humiliating incident.
Once, when I didn't do so well in an exam, a friend came over to play and my mom picked up my exam paper and said, "Your friends will all laugh at you." My friend and I went to hide in my room and drew these pictures on pieces of paper.
Her mother, who gives her name as Mrs. Li, says Dang Dang has tried literally every trick in the book.
There was one move she used to make when she was young. She'd pull down her pants, then present me with her naked butt and say, "Spank me, Mom." Later, if I scolded her, she'd hug my legs and not let go. And when she got even older, she'd lock herself into her room and write notes to me on slips of paper.
Online, there are those who call Dang Dang a bad influence. But the book went viral after her dad, who gives his name as Mr. Chen, posted it on the Chinese version of Twitter. He admits he's not a traditional Chinese dad.
Mostly, we respect her decisions and treat her as an equal. Chinese parents like one adjective, good or obedient. I don't want her to be an obedient child. It just means you're in the system. You can only follow orders. It's only when you think outside the box that you can become creative.
As for the stories of Tiger Mother forcing her kids to practice piano without bathroom breaks or dinner until they get it right, well, that doesn't happen in Dang Dang's house. She plays the guzheng, a kind of Chinese harp, and practices about 40 minutes a night by herself. As for her mum's input, Dang Dang says dismissively, she couldn't tell anyway. She's totally tone deaf. If truth be told, it's pretty clear Dang Dang is a good kid. Despite her guide to getting around mum, neither she nor her mother can remember the last time she was scolded, let alone beaten. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
International coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. I'm Martha Wexler, NPR News, Washington.